It's now my pleasure to introduce our main speaker this evening, Red A. from Buena Park.
Hi, everybody. My name is Red Aldridge, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
I'd like to see the hands of all the guys and the gals in here that are in that first 90 days. Isn't that great? You know, there's no way in the world that I'd ever try to stand up here at a microphone or a podium and tell any of you in this room whether you're alcoholic or not. I don't believe I'm qualified to do that. However, if you start identifying with some of these innermost feelings, some of these symptoms of this disease that I have, I'd sure as hell pay attention. Because you see, what we're dealing with here is a terminal disease. Roll that over your tongue a couple of times. That's got kind of a final ring to it. Means that if you continue to use and abuse the mind-altering drug alcohol, and don't let anybody in this room ever kid you that alcohol is not a drug. Alcohol falls right in the drug category with the ethers and the anesthetics. It's one of the oldest known drugs to man. And it's probably killed more men and women than any other drug. I used and abused this drug over a period of time, regardless of how long it took, until I broke my tolerance to it. You see, Red is allergic to the drug alcohol. When I drink alcohol, I break out in spots. Spots like Acapulco, Las Vegas. In other words, once I take the first drink of that mind-altering drug, I can no longer predict my behavior. If you've been having trouble along those lines, I can guarantee you that tonight you're in the right place. This physical allergy that I developed over a period of time to this drug is not necessarily what makes it such a killer. There is a mental side to the disease, and it usually puts these people to sleep permanently. It's the obsession of the mind, triggered incidentally by the first drink of that mind-altering drug that you take, that tells you that this time it's going to be different. This time I'll be able to predict. This time I'll be able to control. This is the time that alcohol is going to work for me like it always used to. You see, if you have this disease that I have, you have no chance anymore. Because once you pick up the first drink of that mind-altering drug, you trigger your obsession to drink. In the alcoholic, it'll set up a compulsion to drink. And you'll end up again, maybe not today, maybe not even this week. But once you set up that compulsion, you're going to end up in another devastating bout with this damn drug alcohol, in which you're just one step closer to the insanity and death that Sue was reading to you a minute ago when she read from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So the whole idea, the whole concept of this fellowship, if you're new, is to teach us on a daily basis how to stay away from that first drink. You know, the first 100 guys and a gal that were able to do this got together after that first year and they wrote down what they had done. And they called it the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I got to believe that that first 100 guys and a gal must have been spiritually led. Because over a period of the last going on 22 years that Red has been sober a day at a time, I have never found myself in a situation that I couldn't find the solution to in that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous before it was necessary for me to go out there and pick up that first drink. And most of the answers come in those 12 suggested steps that you heard read to you tonight from that portion of chapter 5 and how it works. If you were paying attention at all when Sue read them, they are suggested steps to recovery. But I can guarantee you that there's not a guy or a gal in a hall like this tonight with any length of sobriety at all that ever had them just suggested to them. You're going to have to take them. You're going to have to do the best you can with them on a daily basis for the rest of your life if you want to become a survivor of a terminal disease. Take a look around you in a room like this tonight, and what you see are the survivors of a terminal disease, a disease from which there is no cure, a progressive disease that will continue to get worse for the rest of your life, whether you drink or not. If you wonder why old Red's still standing up here tonight yapping about the same thing after going on 22 years of sobriety, it's because it's more important for me to stay sober today than it was when I was in that first 30 or 60 or 90 days. Over a period of the last 22 years, my disease has continued to progress. And when you hear my story, you know I came from the gates of insanity and death. Ellen and I, my wife here in the front row, had a very dear friend just a few years back try it with over 20 years. That person started to drink at 10 in the morning, and by 4 that afternoon, she was dead. This is the progression of the disease called alcoholism. Don't ever kid yourself that it doesn't get worse, whether we drink or not. I said a minute ago, regardless of how long it took, more and more as I speak from podiums like this around the basin down there where I come from and on these long trips like this good one that I got to make today, I see an awful lot of youth in those audiences out there. And I know a lot of times youth thinks that maybe they got here just a little bit too soon. Maybe that irate judge that's giving you the nudge, maybe that boss that's trying to get you off his back, maybe that family that's trying to get you squared away. If you're thinking like that, my God, forget it. You see, the average age of death today of the guy or the gal with a disease called alcoholism is down to 37. Now, you take a look around you at an audience like this, and you see a lot of us all older type jokers still staggering around. So you know how many kids have got to be out there dying to bring it down to anything like this. It's not extraordinary anymore for somebody to go through the gates of insanity and death before their 16th birthday. Coupled with some of that crap that's out there on the street tonight, pushing this progression along, it's not extraordinary at all for somebody to die before they're even old enough to know what's going on. So if you are in a room like this tonight, try to start to identify with these people. Try to listen to some of these symptoms of this disease. And maybe, just maybe, you might save yourself a hell of a lot of hell right here on earth. I'll get off of this bleeding deacon kick and qualify myself as an alcoholic. I didn't do any drinking at an early age. I had an obsession I wanted to fly. I wanted to fly the biggest and the best airplanes that were ever built. I had a real drawback. I was born back in the Depression years. I don't know whether any of you are old enough to remember those or not. I have a feeling you've had a little touch of them the last two or three. But, you know, things were going tough. They really were. I knew my chances of getting to do something like this were pretty slim. I started investigating. It seemed to be my only chance. It had to be the military. Except back in those days, we didn't have an Air Force, per se. It was part of what was called the old Army Air Corps. And I found to even get into it, I was going to have 2 years of college and a senatorial appointment from the state. I knew the money wasn't going to be there for that education due to the times. I was no great student, but I was a big kid. I figured I could do it athletically. I was born in Colorado, a little town called Fort Collins, just north of Denver. And I stayed clean all the way through high school. I was out for football and basketball. I worked at it real hard. I was lucky enough to win my football scholarship to Colorado State University. I wangled my 2 years of college that way. I got my senatorial appointment, and they sent me to what was then called Randolph Field, which was our old Army Air Corps Academy. And they kept me awful busy for the rest of my training, and through that period of my life, booze was no problem. I graduated as a second lieutenant in the Army Air Corps just prior to us getting into World War II. And I see a few guys out there tonight that can probably remember how unprepared we were for that hassle. You know, our dads were supposed to fought one to end them all, and Congress had never seen too fit to appropriate us the kind of a show we have today. Consequently, we got tossed into that North African campaign over there right at the beginning of that thing against a bunch of guys that had been sitting there practicing for about 3 years, and they'd got pretty good at what they were doing. We were strictly under-trained and for sure under-airplaned, and I found myself in kind of a rough kind of a deal. We were putting up 25 against 200, and we were getting the hell kicked out of us. I came back off of one of those raids very early in that tour of duty, and that particular day, we only got 8 back out of the 25. I was standing in a room, not too unfamiliar to one like this, tables on each side, waiting to go in to talk to the interrogators about what had happened, and old Red was shaking. Now, I think a lot of you in rooms like this can identify with adrenaline. Adrenaline shakes. You know, if you've lived on that fast lane type life for any length of time at all, you'll recognize adrenaline shakes. Now, they weren't new to me. I'd had adrenaline shakes before. You know, you stand there and wait for that football to come down with that 250-pound lineman about to nail you, and you'll quiver. I know you're a damn who you are, but you get into it, you get over it, and I knew I'd get over it again, but this flight surgeon standing there looking at me wasn't that sure. He says, "What's the matter, Red?" And I said, "Nothing, I'll be all right, sir." He looked at me for a few minutes, and he says, "Young man, I got just what you need." I had never paid too much attention to that medicinal table that they had set up there in operations. But on it, they had about a half a dozen open fifths of what they call medicinal whiskey. Think about that for a few minutes. Whiskey is a medicine. He picked up a water glass, and he poured old Red about 2 fingers, and he said, "Here, drink this." And I said, "I don't want it." He says, "Young man, I prescribe it." So just to get him off my back, I picked it up, turned it up, drank it, and walked on into interrogation. Sat down, and if you got an alcoholic personality like I have, I think you know what happened. Hell, that stuff sat there and flowed out to those fingertips and out there to those toes, and I looked down, and they were roped. You know, 10 minutes before, I hadn't been able to light a cigarette or pick up a cup of coffee. 10 minutes down the line with a half a glass of booze in me, I'm looking at them, they're frozen, just like they are tonight. And old Red never shook at anything again for the next 20 years. I thought I had found the elixir of life. I really believed it. And booze worked that well for me for a hell of a long time. Even after it started doing to me, it would still do for me. I soon found to get the full benefit out of it, I had to recreate the kind of a situation I'd had that first day. Probably combat's the best adrenaline builder I ever found before or since. I became a combat freak. I stayed for 3 years and 2 tours of duty. And I got good at what I was doing. I learned to live on that knife's edge. And I think a lot of you can identify with living on that knife's edge. You know, booze was always there at the end of the day to bust it. I used to come in at night and see guys sitting on the edge of their beds worried about going the next day. And I'd look at them and think, "God, I wish they could find alcohol." Never dawned on me one time that maybe there might be something wrong with me that it worked that well for me. I went right on through World War II. I was back here in the States. I probably should have been able to lay that medication down and go on about my business. But in retrospect, I think I started running into one of the first symptoms of this disease. Some of you might identify with it. It's called justification. Rather than laying that booze down, I went looking for a job that had some excitement to it. All the real good airplanes, the jet-type airplanes we got today, were just coming off the drawing boards. They were looking for guys that had a lot of combat experience to evaluate them. I put my application in. I got accepted as a test pilot to the Proving Ground Command, and the excitement was back. I was getting to fly the kind of airplanes now that I'd laid on those Colorado hillsides and dreamt about when I was a kid. You know, I knew I was getting to fly with the best. Booze was still working for me. I think maybe it started working a little bit too well about this time. I'd always been a binge drinker at the end of the day. You know, there at the Proving Ground Command, they had a big officers club out there in the Gulf. It's at Fort Walton. In fact, it's still the Proving Ground. And, you know, I'd catch myself sticking out at that club till 2 o'clock in the morning a lot of nights, just kind of tranquilizing the day. And I'd know I had a 6:30 test off. Now, not always for sure, but every once in a while I'd catch myself waking up in that BOQ at around 11:30 in the morning with that cold sweat start we come to it. And I'd look at my watch and say, did I or didn't I? You know, you pick up the phone, you call the sergeant, and I say, did you get everything written up they wanted this morning? Yes, sir, right down the line. You walk back down there and you step up on the wing of that bird and the knee pad is yours. The checkoffs are yours. Signature is yours. Geolometer says you've been up to speed of sound and the only thing that you don't recall is going. Now, don't kid me that it hadn't happened to you. You know, you step out there on that porch in the morning, you look at that car in that driveway and you say, how did it get home last night? Or how did I get home last night? Blackout, one of the earliest symptoms of this disease, the overuse and abuse of the drug alcohol to the point that it blacks out the conscious mind. If you got any coordination at all, you're going to get by with a hell of a lot of it. I've seen guys go for a week in a blackout, yet you never even see them stagger, and they had no idea where they were or what they were doing. Should you scare the living hell out of an alcoholic, and I don't believe I've ever found one that it bothered too much. We write her off with the idea that, God, I must have had a good time last night. We go right through these symptoms. We really do. In the occupation I was in, I knew it wasn't exactly what I was looking for sure. And I started my first feeble attempts, I guess, about this time to try to control this drug. I'd always been a binge drinker, like I say, at the end of the day. I found that if I was going to exercise any control at all, I had to string it out over a longer period of time. And I think that's how a lot of us become daily drinkers. You know, I think what I became for a lot of years was what I like to refer to as a functioning drunk. You know, I never did give up drinking. I did give up binge drinking. And I just kind of strung it out over a longer period of time. And it worked. It worked real well for me that way for a long time. Most of the real good airplanes I'd really wanted to test were off the drawing board. I was looking for something maybe had a little more kick to it, and as usual, the Air Force come up with it. We found we'd let way too many guys out right after World War II. They started a big recruiting campaign to get the key personnel to come back. And one of the promotional aspects they come up with was the organization of what's still known today as the Air Force Aerobatic Team. You know, you don't get sentenced to that team. You volunteer for it. And I volunteered. They screen you pretty good. You got to have the qualifications. It's not all fun and games. You practice at it 4.5 days a week. You fly 32 air shows around the country a year. They only let you do it for 2 years, and that's probably enough, but it's an adrenaline building, son of a gun. And all of a sudden, I'm back flying with the best, and I knew it again. Booze was still working for me. I think I started running into another symptom about this time. Maybe some of you might identify with this one. It's called hangover. I never found, before or since, a worse place to shake a hangover than an aerobatic formation. If you walk out there that line in the morning, you step up on the wing of that bird, if you got any claustrophobia at all, you're lost, because that canopy is coming down and you're trapped. You know, there's no way in the world you're going to stop at a corner beer tavern, that's for sure. You hook that oxygen mask across your face, and you can no longer become ill. You pull into that 18-inch interval formation, and those guys just insist that you don't shake. I started running into another symptom. Maybe you might identify with this one. The deep sweats. God, I used to sit there and wonder, how come? How come something that's always worked for me so well for so long is beginning to kick me around like this? I used to try to analyze it. I got to thinking, you know, maybe it's the life you've been leading for a long time, Red. Maybe at the end of your 2 years, if you resign and get out, get in the civilian life, get a business started, get a family going, do the things I'd seen my buddies do, that I could get a handle on this drinking. I always believed right up until I had both feet through the gates of insanity and death that given the right set of circumstances, I could control my drinking. I think this philosophy of self-sufficiency that we all grow up with from kids, where every guy and every gal should probably be an island to themselves, is probably what helps about 14 to 16 million of those practicing alcoholics that are out there tonight still pumping that stuff down, self-medicate themselves right out of this world without ever finding what we find in rooms like this, that there is a way out. I finished my 2 years and I resigned. I went into civilian life. And you know, all those guys, all my buddies had been out there about 4.5 years ahead of me. They got out right after World War II. They had good businesses. They had homes built. They had families going. If you got an alcoholic personality like I have, you know what you're going to do. You're going to double up and catch up. And that's the way I hit civilian life. You know, I went into business. It was immediately successful. I built a tri-level home. I got married. I started a family. The business was good. In fact, it's the same kind of business I'm still in today. You guys contributed an awful lot to it in your drinking careers. It's called the auto body business. But if I'd have worked at it 8 hours a day, I think I'd have been all right. But I wasn't working that way. I was going to catch all those guys out there, and I was working 12 and 14 and 16 hours a day. And I went to 6 days a week, and then I put on 2 shifts. Well, I got that tri-level home down there paid for in a short period of time. I got a trust fund started for the kids to get them through college, and they're only 1 and 3. But this is the way we think. And I'd come through those doors at night, so beat I could hardly hold my head up. And there was one thing I could always sell old Red on. Man, if there's anything you've earned yourself today, type. And you know what it was. It was a drink of booze, and I was never any better than I was sweating hangovers at 30,000. A strange thing happened to me about this time in my life. Oh, Harry Truman got his foot in his mouth and sicked us on Korea. I was telling you we hadn't trained any fighter pilots, and he found it out, and he had to call the war worries. And God, just 21 days from the day I was recalled, I looked out there, I got 2 500-pound napalms nailed to each wing again. They're saying, sick 'em, Tiger, they just went that way. I got another 100 missions to do. You know, I'm 33 years old by this time. I know that don't sound too old, but it's getting old for a fighter pilot, especially one with a progressive disease. I had no idea that I had a progressive disease. I was still passing Class A physicals every 6 months. How could a guy have a terminal disease? You know? But when I started to do that new 100 in Korea, something became quite evident to old Red in a hurry. Those damn missions had got too long between drinks. See, I'd been a daily drinker now for a heck of a long time. I steal this phrase from my wife's pitch. She says, those chains of alcoholism lie so lightly on our shoulders that I don't think a lot of us realize they're there until we're completely enmeshed. Until all of a sudden we wake up one morning to the fact that we are no longer telling alcohol when we're going to drink it. Alcohol is beginning to tell us when we're going to drink it. I solved that situation very simply. I just went over to the PX and bought myself 2 8-ounce flasks. One for each winter flight boot. And hell, it worked great. I'd use the right one going out and the left one coming home. A long time after booze started doing to me, it would still do for me. It brought out very vividly to me just how hooked I was getting along about my 40th mission. I got shot up again for about the umpteenth time in my life, and the shell come through the bottom of the airplane right through my left leg, and it kicked it clear into my chin. I still remember getting my foot back down on that rudder, and I could feel liquid running into that left winter flight boot, and I still remember sticking my hand down there and pulling her back and thinking, hot dog, it's blood. Two and a half hours to come home. If you've ever been shot up, you know how fast you go into shock. If you're hooked on a drug, it'll really put you in withdrawal in a hurry. This was the way that alcohol was beginning to cause Red to think. I finished my 100, all right. I got back here to the States. You know, I got to thinking that maybe, Red, you could find yourself an assignment far enough away from alcohol. Maybe there's some place that you could get far enough away from booze. That'd help. They were just starting to build the radar sites up across the Arctic Circle. Alaska, Canada, and Greenland. And I went north. If any of you guys or gals are thinking about that, my God, forget it. The only way those people stay alive up there is to drink booze. You'd freeze to death in that part of the world without alcohol. I spent a year in Thule, Greenland, where the warmest day we had was 23 below. So cold weather won't do it. You know, I just won't. You know, I remember coming down to Harmon, that big Seagram's distillery there in Newfoundland, to pick up the monthly ration of booze for that base up there in Thule. It's only about 450 miles from the North Pole. I brought down a twin-engine airplane that afternoon, and I loaded her clear down with those big 40-ounce jugs of that Canadian CC and VO. And I started back up there that night, and I got into one of the damnedest Arctic storms I was ever in, and I lost an engine. It was one of those nights I called Air Sea Rescue, and those bastards wouldn't even come out. And I fought that thing all night, and I got into Thule just at Arctic dawn, and the whole base was down there to meet me. I got to thinking, isn't it great they're that worried about old Red? I don't know whether you guys or gals had this problem or not, but as a daily drinker, I was developing a hell of a smell problem. When you drink booze all day like I did, you begin to smell like booze all day. I got to thinking that maybe if I'd get back to Europe where they got that wine on the table and they eat a lot of garlic, that at least I'd blend in better. So I volunteered for Fleet Line Service, which is the airline that resupplies NATO. And you know what my northern run was? Brussels, Amsterdam, Copenhagen, Oslo, and Stockholm. Those are progressive disease towns. You know, I was picking up a lot of rank over the years as I went along, and they kept trying to trap me for command. And they got it done about this time. They jerked me back here to the States and stuck me up here at San Rafael, Hamilton Field. Gave me an air defense group. Now I got about 800 men in my command. Every morning I hear my airplanes roll. Seemed like invariably I'd look out there at that outer office of mine, and that adjutant of mine would always have about a half a dozen of my boys sitting out there waiting for me to talk to. And I found an awful lot of my mornings used to be taken up giving temperance lectures. These kids had been in town getting themselves into trouble drinking. I had a system. I had an eyes-on safe alongside my desk, and I used to keep a 40-ounce jug of Smirnoff Red Vodka in there with a hooked glass straw. And every time he'd go out to get one of the boys, I'd hit the safe, and usually by noon I was giving some pretty good lectures. I was becoming more and more conscious of the fact that I wasn't giving the Air Force what they deserved, that was for sure. They'd always been awful good, though, Red, and I figured I sure owed them more than I was giving them. And again, I decided to resign. This time, it didn't work. My resignation got as far as Air Defense Command at Colorado Springs, and they bounced it. They bounced it with a recommendation that I be sent to Parks for 3 months psychoanalysis. They couldn't figure out why a 15-year light colonel all of a sudden wanted to throw his command in. Now, I couldn't very well go in there and tell those guys why. If we had any other terminal disease, we'd be in there on that doctor's doorstep every morning laying the symptoms on him. You know, telling him, God, Doc, this is where it hurts. You can drag that dying alcoholic into that same doctor's office. They'll read him that same set of questions when it comes to that one where it says, do you drink excessively? Oh, a couple of beers now and then, Doc. Self-denial is the greatest symptom of the disease of alcoholism of any of the other symptoms I've been talking about. Our complete lack of convincing our innermost self that we really have a problem. Now, don't get me wrong. Psychiatry was probably the first help that was ever offered to me as an alcoholic. I don't believe that psychiatry can help the practicing alcoholic because the one thing a psychiatrist has to have going for him before he can help anybody is a little thing called self-honesty. And this is something that's completely lacking in the practicing alcoholic. Nobody in this room couldn't be helped by psychiatry, I don't think. I got to tell you my psych story. It's about a guy that had an obsession. He had an obsession. He had a purple screw for a belly button. Now, he knew it was an obsession, but every time he looked down, there's this bright purple screw right where his belly button should be. He hadn't had a good night's sleep in months, and he finally goes to this shrink and he says, can you help me? And the guy says, I can. He says, I just got this new potion in. He says, I want you to take it home, get in your best pajamas, open your bedroom window, drink this stuff down. He says, it'll float a little pink cloud. It'll have a little yellow-handled screwdriver on it. Unscrew that thing, let it float out. He says, you're going to turn out all right. He was so excited about it, he says, I'm going right now, Doc. He went running home, he went through the routine, and it worked. In floated the little cloud, he unscrewed it, out it floated. And he got the night's sleep that he'd been looking for years. Completely refreshed when he woke up. Covers were up. Finally got his nerve up and he took a quick look. And sure enough, a normal belly button. He was just elated and he jumped out of bed and his ass fell off. The reason I tell this story is it's because it's the exact way that psychiatry worked for Old Red. They would fix me up. I would jump out there and off it would fall again. They did let me out. Family has long since got tired of Red shenanigans and been on their way. My folks had moved out here to the West Coast and been fairly successful. Those of you who are familiar with the basin, they had a big home on that hill there behind San Pedro, Palo Verde Hills. Big old den with a boob tube and everything. I figured I'll get up there in that big den with that beautiful view of Los Angeles Harbor and I'll kick back and all the pressures are off now. All the things that I thought I'd been getting drunk at a lot of years are off my back. I'll sit up there and I'll get well. I lasted about 2 weeks up there. There was one of these big wooden globes, one of those Columbus-type globes sitting in that den, and I kept looking at it and thinking, you know, maybe, Red, you've never taken a true geographic. I'd always been around guys that could cover for me, guys that I'd flown combat with or gone to school with. I figured if I'd get someplace in this world far enough away from anybody that knew me, that I'd have to do it on my own. I run my finger up over the meridian like any true pilot would to see what was on the other side of the world from Palo Verde. If you want to try it, it's Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. One month later, I was flying captain on Ethiopian Airlines. I'm halfway around the world again. Nobody knows old Red. All they know is he's got lots of flying time and he's qualified, and I gave it my best shot. I don't know whether any of you guys or gals tried white-knuckle sobriety or not, but old Red stayed sober a year on guts. I can tell you right now, it was the most miserable year I ever spent before or since. There wasn't a waking moment in that year that I didn't want to drink. I'd wake up in the middle of the night, and I'd go down to the kitchen and pour myself one and set it on the table and sweat it. Prove to yourself you got guts enough to leave it alone, Red.
I'd go to a movie and I'd have to get up in the middle of it and go to the bar and have the bartender pour me one. Not drink it. Sit there and sweat it. Prove to yourself you got guts enough. And that's the way I went through that year. And at the end of it, I figured, well, there's one thing you proved, Tiger. At least you're not an alcoholic. And I went out to celebrate. That was my last fight. I don't remember fighting after that. You know, we come up that hill, so gradually we hit that level off period, and we finally get over on the back side of that alcoholic curve. Now, once you're on the back side of that curve, you're going to start donating to the pot to reserve your right to use that drug. Usually jobs, securities, homes, things that we've worked at through most of our lives. All of a sudden, we find ourselves tossing them into the pot to reserve our right to use that drug. Families, loved ones, people that have stuck by us through hell and high water, all of a sudden we're tossing them into the pot to reserve our right to use that drug. Integrity, self-respect, anything that means anything to you, if you want to hang out there as long as old Red did, you're going to have to get it in the pot. I used to look down and I'd say, if I ever got like that joker, I'd quit. And pretty soon I'd be just like him and I'd say, I mean that one down there. And down that hill I went to where pretty soon there wasn't anybody down there but me. It wasn't too many years before I couldn't hold down an airline job. My reputation was beginning to precede me. In Africa about that time, most of those colonial powers were going independent. And I found there was a hell of a demand for the kind of flying I'd been doing most of my life. And all of a sudden I found old Red shooting at people for money. You know, this has a funny effect on your insides. I'd always had at least principles to fight for through a couple of wars. Now I'm just sitting there shooting at people to support a habit that I don't seem to be able to do too much about. There's an awful lot of other pressures that can be put on a practicing alcoholic. You know, I told you I'd been CO of an air defense group that had helped build the radar sites. I'd had a top secret clearance for most of my life. All of a sudden, I'm working for a foreign government. You hear things like OSI and CIA. You don't think too much about them, but those guys are out there. And they can give a practicing alcoholic fits. They know who's paying you. They know where you're banking it. They're opening your mail. All those things that don't go down well. You know, the maintenance isn't worth a damn. You don't want to get shot down in that part of the world. All these pressures are building. I'm doing the one thing that I've always had that worked, pumping that flit in there, and boy, it got worse. It finally got so bad they quit hiring me for that kind of stuff. I ended up, and I'm sure not proud of anything that I'm going to tell you, flying through mountain passes with my landing lights on railroad tracks now for navigation. Now all my flights are low-level over water. My landing fields are deserted beaches. And you can probably guess what I'm doing. I'm smuggling because that's where the money really is. That's where all the fears are, too. See, if I get caught doing what I'm doing now, they're going to put me away for life. And yet, booze took all those deterrents away. If you want to hang out there as long as I did, it'll do the same for you. I kept right on with that kind of a life until I finally got so bad they just quit hiring me for it. I was back here in the States. I was 41 years old. Probably about as unemployable as a guy can get. I figured there wasn't too many things in this world I hadn't tried a couple of times. If I couldn't whip it, at least I could get with it. And I bought myself 10 cases of those 40-ounce jugs of that Smirnoff Red Vodka. And I stuck them in that hillside over there in Palo Verde, and I went on what was supposed to be old Red's last drunk. And it just almost was. That drunk lasted 60 days. The last 30 of it, I was too sick to eat. People over on the side of that hill didn't have any idea what was the matter with me. I'd always been out there among them. They knew I was getting awful sick physically, and they started calling around to see if they could get me some help. Thank God it was Southern California, because I know today that the doctor that made that house call out there didn't do it because of his Hippocratic Oath. He did it because he's a member of a fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, God chose that doctor, I think. When those people made the call, he didn't have any trouble at all identifying with those symptoms. He came out and he did what he could for me physically. And he told those people what I was up against. said that he'd seen some amazing recovery on a program that he himself was trying, that he was going to do what he could for me physically, and he's going to leave some names, and if I ask for help, to call you. I don't remember ever getting that well. I was down to 138 pounds of emaciation. My normal weight's about 210. I think those people out there just thought I was going to die, and they called you, because my first recollection of you sober guys and gals in rooms like this were those alcoholics sitting on the edge of that bed, sober alcoholics. They literally nursed old Red back to health and started to haul me into rooms like this. And they kept me way back there in Half Major's Row for a long time. They didn't want to completely discourage the other newcomers. I was kind of a wet-brained babbling idiot, really. Thank God it's Southern California where you read this portion of Chapter 5 like you did tonight. Because I think that's what saved my life. I wasn't capable of hearing too much. I could hear, just don't drink today, and then they'd read those 12 suggested steps. And you know, sat back there one night, I caught myself identifying. I couldn't figure out what it was that I was trying to put together. And then all of a sudden, it just came crashing in. See, for many years, drunk or sober, the only thing that had ever kept me alive in those complicated airplanes I'd been flying was called a checklist. A list in which everything I had to do was written down. And drunk or sober, I'd never gone near a bird in my life that I hadn't used that list from the time I walked away till the time I walked up until the time I walked away. And it would get me through one flight. And sitting back there that night, all of a sudden it dawned on me what 24 hours really is. 24 hours. Just one flight in life. And those 12 suggested steps are the checklist to keep you from having to go out there and pick up that first drink of booze. I've been using that 12-step checklist on a daily basis now for the last going on 22 years. I've never found it necessary to go out there and pick up that drink. Haven't had to take any tranquilizing, sedating, or elevating pills. Haven't had to smoke any funny grass. I've probably been as close to chemically free as a guy can stay in this modern world. And I owe it all to you guys. See, on my own, I had given it my best shot, and I had never scratched the surface. Everything that I've been talking about tonight, I have learned in rooms like this. For those guys and gals that got their hand up tonight, you know, when you get up in an Alcoholic Anonymous meeting and you say, my name is Red and I'm an alcoholic, you pretty well got that number one step nailed on that checklist. That's primarily what they're talking about. When we're finally able to get up in front of a bunch of our peers and admit to them and our innermost selves that we really do have a problem, that we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives are unmanageable. That's about what you've done when you get your hand up. But if you're anything like I was, when you read that step number two, that thing will just shake the living hell out of you. Because there's a real inference in that step. I'm going to have to ask a power greater than old Red to restore me to sanity. You know, before I can take that step, I got to admit I'm nuts. And I got to admit that I was, because where else would you find a guy completely allergic to a drug, if he continued to use it, was going to kill him, that went out there and pumped it down a couple of fifths a day? Now, there's got to be a lot of insanity in us. Don't let it shake you too much. I'm going to tell you my insanity story. You know, I do a lot of yapping from these podiums down there in the basin. By the time I get my shop closed there in Long Beach and get out to Buena Park and change clothes and get out to the valley or down to San Diego or out to Oxnard, I'm always driving like a son of a gun to get there in time. And this guy was doing the same thing. He only had about 10 minutes to make this meeting he had to speak at. He was still on the freeway, off-ramp, coming up, thought he had it nailed. Hit his off-ramp, got about three or four blocks down the street, and blew a tire. Jumped out, and it was flat, all right. He thought, well, maybe I can still make it. He jerked his trunk open, got his spare out, jacked his car up, whipped the lug nuts off, put them in a hubcap behind him. He just setting his spare up, car come whizzing along behind him, caught the edge of the hubcap, flipped all his lug nuts right out in the weeds. And he's frantic. He's out there beating these weeds to death, and it's dark, and he's wringing his hands, and he knows he's going to be late. And all of a sudden he heard a voice. Hadn't paid any attention where he'd rolled to a stop. looked up and he was parked right in front of an institution for the alcoholically insane. One of the inmates sitting up there on the fence had been watching all this, and he says, "Hey, mister." The guy says, "I haven't got time to talk to you right now." He says, "I'm in a hell of a hurry." The guy up on the fence says, "You know, I've been sitting up here watching you." He says, "I figured you must be." He says, "If I was in that big a hurry, I'd take the other three hubcaps off and take a lug nut off of each wheel and put that thing on there and get going." The guy stood there for a minute, you know, and he thought about it, and he says, "You know," he says, "that's the answer, isn't it?" He says, "How did you come up with that? I thought you were insane." And the guy says, "Well, I am, but that's no sign I'm stupid." The point I'm trying to make is when all of us come through those doors over there, we are a wee bit bent out of shape. We have been out there beating on ourselves for a long time. The mere fact that we come looking for help sure as hell proves that we're not stupid. This is where the answers are. Rooms like this, men and women sharing their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that we can solve this common problem. Man, I hit that step number 3, and I run into that word God. And I went running for my sponsor. And I said, "Is that the God they're talking about, man?" He says, "Yeah, Red." And I says, "You know my background, Mac. I'd have 200,000 years in purgatory to do before I can start." He says, "Dummy, you didn't read the rest of the thing. It says, a God of your understanding." Now, I had no idea what he was talking about. But you know what I could believe in? I was going to have to turn my will and my life over to a power greater than old Red. And it was you guys. You were the power I'd been looking for a long time. I could look at the group and I could see that they were staying sober together. Group power I could understand. I'd been tucked up in groups all my life. As long as I was in the group, I had all the firepower in the world. It was only when I was out there as a straggler I was going to get my ass shot down. So I started hanging with the winners, the guys that had some time on this program. I started picking their brains, and they taught me, real good about this power that today old Red calls God. You see, my sobriety on a daily basis is a gift from that power. And you guys. In other words, my sobriety is a gift from God. What I do with my sobriety is my gift back to Him. He's let me become part of that pipeline of information started by that first 100 guys and a gal that put that big book together. The only way I can keep it is to keep giving it away. I got to be standing there at that door with my hand out when the guy that still suffers comes through. This is the fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. It'll get better. It really will. I had no idea, we were talking about this at dinner tonight, of what spiritual was. I got to go to a convention about my first 60 days, and I run into an old boy from the podium, and he sounded spiritual. And I thought, I'll corner this guy after this meeting, and I'll find out what that is. This old boy was a Georgia bread salesman. And he must have been a good one, because when he finally got so bad that he could no longer drive his truck, nobody would buy bread from anybody but him. And they finally had to hire him a chauffeur just to drive him around. That kind of a likable guy. And he still was. And I could identify with him. I said, "Tell me about spiritual." And he says, "Red," he says, "I had trouble with that. And I went over to the public library and I got the dictionary down." He says, "I opened it up to the word and it didn't do too much for me, so I got all the dictionaries down in the building." He says, "I opened them all up, I copied all the definitions, and then I took a consensus," and he says, "Do you know what spiritual is?" I said, "That's what I'm looking for, something this alky brain can handle." He said, "Red, spiritual is that which is not material." Think about that for a few minutes. What have I got going for me in those 12 suggested steps that are going to completely change my life, as they say they will? And the more I got to thinking about it, the more I read that big book to see what was really true. And you know, in 5 different places in that big book, it says that the one thread, the one trend that seems to run through all our personalities as alcoholics is a little thing called emotional immaturity. Man alive. What were they talking about then? Attitudes and emotions. That's what I came up with. These are the things that I was going to have to change if I was going to grow spiritually. And over a period of years, that's exactly what I've had to work on. The obsession to drink left me probably in that first 30 or 60 or 90 days. I don't know when it left. It's never been back since, and I hope it never returns. But I've been working on those character defects on a daily basis ever since. My attitudes prior to finding you guys, when I stepped out there and looked at the day, was, oh, God, another day. And they'd been that way a long time. What you guys have taught me is to step out there and take a look at it and say, thank God, another day. I've been granted one that I shouldn't have had. See, the average age of death when I come on this program was 41. And I told you a minute ago how old old Red was. I just barely snuck in. Means that every day I've been granted over the last 22 years has been a gift from you guys and God. And you can't get too ungrateful for a situation like that. I got to tell you my attitude story. It's about a guy like I get up at one of these podiums, I get right up on cloud nine. And this guy come whipping into a barbershop not too long ago, and he was right up on cloud nine. He got in the chair, and his barber says, what are you so happy about? The guy says, I got a 747 reservation going to Rome. So I'm going over there and eat some of that good Italian food. He says, I even got an audience with the Pope. Barber looked at him and says, what's the matter with you, man? He said, that 747 is the roughest airplane in the sky. He says, you'll be airsick all the way over there. He says, you start eating that Italian food and Montezuma's revenge is going to seem mild. He says, you know the Pope isn't going to have time for a commoner like you. Well, a guy had gone in there right up on nine. He came out after the haircut right down in the pits, you know, right where those norms usually jerk me. And he didn't... He didn't see him for about 30 days, and all of a sudden he come bouncing back in, and he is really out of sight now. Barber got him back in the chair, and he says, what now? He says, I made that trip. He says, that 747 is the smoothest airplane in the sky. He says, there wasn't a ripple going over. He says, I gained 12 pounds eating that Italian food, the best I ever had. He says, I even got my audience with the Pope. I got to kneel at his feet, kiss his ring, and he says, would you believe it? He even had a question for me. Barbara looked at him. He says, what could he have possibly ask you? He says, where did you get that lousy haircut? Don't let him tear you down. You know, I had a hard time. I looked up that word immaturity in the dictionary. And you know what it said? Childlike. How could a 41-year-old fighter pilot be childlike? They don't have childlike emotions. I had a hell of a time identifying with that in the first place. I don't today. For a very simple reason. Down there in Buena Park, where I live, every Saturday morning, along about 9 o'clock, there's a knock on old Red's front door. It's all the kids in the neighborhood gathered out there on my lawn wanting to know if I can come out and play. And I do. You know, some of those kids that come knocking on that door have been doing it now for around 16, 18 years. Some of those kids I used to help put their wheels on their bikes, I'm now helping them port and relieve their automobiles. But we've always had a good thing going because we could understand each other. I never could quite realize why I got along with kids so well. I realize today that the reason I always did is because I don't have to talk down to them. I talk directly to them just like I'm talking to you, immature bastards, and you know what I'm talking about. Did you ever see one of those little guys get mad? He gets red-faced, fists clenched, drawn back, swinging angry mad. Is this the kind of mad you recognize? This is the kind I do. When I was 4 years old, they said, you've got a red-headed temper. I said, I have. I'll cultivate it. Man, I worked on it. I really did. You watch one of those little guys when he's jealous, he's tromping his best buddy. He's going to get his own way or else. Does this remind you of anybody? He'll pick up a resentment and he won't talk to the rest of us for the rest of the day. He's going to punish us. Childlike emotions. I still have to work on them on a daily basis, but they're getting better. They're getting better right along. That young lady down there in that front row, I don't know whether you guys are anything like I was, but when I was in that first 30 days and started to get well enough to open my eyes, we immediately began to look for the prettiest girl in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she come walking in along about that time, and thank God I hadn't read all those things about early involvements. We did get involved, and it's been a lot of fun. Two alcoholics growing up together. You know, if you move two chiefs under one roof with no Indians, you got a lot of button pushing to be done. And there's been a lot of buttons pushed over the years. But we really have grown up together. And I think over a period of the last few years especially, what we have really become is friends. And you know, when you can really become friends with the person that you're married to, you got a pretty good relationship. It really works. I think probably that alcoholics are probably the most impatient people that there are when it comes to waiting for God's will for us. That's what causes most of that button pushing, you know. We still want our will done. I heard a story the other day kind of illustrates. I think this guy must have been an alcoholic. I heard one of the comedians from Vegas telling it, but it kind of illustrates the point. During those last big rains we had just before Christmas last year down there in the basin, all this water was running down through a guy's yard. And it was getting deeper and deeper, and he was out there just sandbagging like a son of a gun trying to get that water stopped. And he wasn't doing too much good. It was getting deeper and deeper, and about that time a guy in a rowboat came by, and he says, "Hey, old buddy," he says, "you're in trouble." He says, "Jump in here," and he says, "I'm going to get you out of here." The guy looked around, and he says, "Ah, don't worry about it." He says, "God's going to take care of me." And he kept right on sandbagging, and it kept getting deeper, and it finally got up to about his neck. And about that time, a guy in a helicopter spotted him, and he flew over, and he says, "I'm going to drop you a basket." He says, "You're really in deep trouble." He says, "Jump in here, and I'll get you out of here." And the guy looked around, and he says, "Don't worry about it." He says, "God's going to take care of me." And he kept right on sandbagging, and it finally got so deep he drowned. Now, he got up to the pearly gates, and he knocked, and St. Pete come to the door, and he says, "Who are you?" And he says, "I'm the guy that just drowned down there in the flood." Pete turned around to God and says, "Are we going to let him in?" And God says, "By all means." He says, "That guy really needs help." He says, "I already sent a boat and a helicopter by for him." God's will for us is a little hard to come by sometimes. You know, we pass it up and don't even recognize it a lot of times, I think. I still have a lot of trouble. I wish to hell I could work this program as well as I can talk it. You know, I always get it right the second time. Got to share my second time story with you. This kid had been out of work for quite a while during this recession that we'd had. And he finally got himself a good job in a big supermarket in the produce department. And he was keeping all the lettuce and the tomatoes and the vegetables and the fruits all wet down and shined and looking good. And everything was going great, except one afternoon a guy come walking in, and he cornered him, and he says, "Young man," he says, "I want to buy a half a head of your lettuce." Now the kid looked at him and said, "Sir," he says, "I'm sorry." He says, "We just don't sell half a heads of lettuce." Now I deal with the public every day, and I know how irritating they can really get when they want to. And he stayed right on this kid. He says, "Now, wait a minute." He says, "I'm a bachelor." He says, "Look at the price of that stuff." He says, "I'd never use it all." He says, "Just sell me a half a head of lettuce." Kid stuck with his guns. He says, "I'm sorry, sir." He says, "We don't sell it that way." You know, the guy just stayed right on his back. He says, "Why don't you go back there and ask your store manager whether he'll sell me a half a head of lettuce?" By this time, the kid is storming, and I can understand these kind of emotions. He went storming back into that store manager's office, and he says, there's some half-assed character out here that wants to buy half a head of lettuce. And he looked around, and the guy had walked in right behind him, and he said, and this gentleman here would like to buy the other half. Get it right the second time. You know, I have an awful time with that turn it over button. I don't know whether you guys have that trouble or not. I don't have too much trouble turning it over, but I have a hard time leaving it there for any length of time. I had a situation not too long ago. In fact, it was a series of situations down at the shop, and I really didn't want to go down that morning to face them. And I kept hemming and hawing around the house there in Buena Park, and it keeps getting later and later. And, you know, finally I'm running late. And I jumped out on that 91 freeway, and when I'm running late, I'm blowing horns and cutting guys out and giving them the finger and building a head of steam, and you know, I haven't even got to work yet. Whenever old Red starts to act that way, that monster inside of me begins to lash. That one that used to whip me right over there to that corner tavern for a leaf. And you know, I got to run that checklist whenever that monster starts to lash anymore. And I hit that turn it over button, and you know, it's frozen in the down position. I haven't turned anything over. I talked to God just like I'm talking to you guys, and I said, okay, sir, I'll just go down and do the footwork. You handle it. I got down there, and you know, none of that stuff that I'd anticipated ever did show up. Everything that did come in was just as smooth as glass. It was a beautiful day, in fact. I jumped in that same car that night, started back down 91 on my way home, and guess who I'm patting on the back for the way I handled that situation? And all of a sudden it dawned on me what I was doing, and I busted out laughing. And I looked over, and the guys driving on each side of me on the freeway were turning my station. You know, they're trying to find out what I'm so happy about. Well, what happened was it reminded me of a story I used to use back in my combat days. Story about credit, where credit's due. You know, I had 6 questers in my DFC, and when I'd wear them, guys would look at me and they'd say, where'd you get all those, Red? And I used to have a stock answer that I got pushed in the pond. But I did fly a lot of combat, and they just hung them on me is where I got them. And, but the story goes like this. Credit where credit's due. It was about a Texas rancher. He had one of the biggest spreads in Texas. Thousands of acres, big old ranch house, big old Olympic-sized pool, big old barbecue area. And just as a conversation piece, he built himself about 150-yard across alligator pond. And he filled it with the meanest alligators he could find the world over, these big old 15-foot snappers. And he didn't feed them too good. He kept mean out there. And all these guys got out there one afternoon telling these war stories and drinking these flit, and this Texan finally got a little tired of it. He says, I'll tell you what I'll do. He says, any of you guys want to go down there and prove your courage? He says, anybody will go down there and swim across that alligator pond, I'll give you my daughter's hand in marriage, $1 million or a ranch like mine. And he figured no takers. He no more turned his back. He hears all this commotion. He turned around, and here this guy is swimming out across that pond. And he is moving out. He's leaving a rooster tail. And he made it. Texan run around, he helped him out, and he says, I've never seen such a display of courage. He says, I'll stick with my bargain. He says, I imagine you want my daughter's hand in marriage. The guy looked at him, he says, oh, no, sir. He says, I'm already married. He looked at him, he says, well, then it's got to be $1 million. The guy says, no, sir. He says, I have an income for life. Well, the Texan looked at him, he says, then it's got to be the ranch like mine. The guy looked at him and says, no, sir. He says, my daddy left me one in his will. Texan looked at him in complete amazement. He says, well, what do you want? He says, I want the name of that son of a bitch that pushed me in the pond. let's all remember that we all got pushed in that pond of alcohol. Probably no human power could have ever got us out of there. God can and will if he is sought. May you find him now. May that power watch over us all, day at a time, through the eternity of our spiritual existence. I sure do want to thank you guys for letting me come up and share.